in the Clinton impeachment. If we were in other countries, we would all right now, all of us together, would go down to Washington and we would stone Congressman Hyde to death. We would stone Henry Hyde to death and we would go to their homes and we'd kill their wives and their children. We would kill their families. What's happening in this country? What is happening? This is Sean Penn. I am not disturbed by Ronald Reagan's Alzheimer's. You know, there's not a lot of cleaner pictures of karma in the world. I mean, it's not a very Christian way of thinking. I do stray sometimes. But I go right from him mocking the farm workers and eating grapes on television during the boycott to him dribbling today. And I feel a sense of justice. And again, Janine Garofalo. What you have now is people that are closet racists, misogynists, homophobes, and people who love tilted playing fields and the politics of exclusion identifying as conservatives. 83. The dumb and vicious celebrity. This is Linda Ronstadt. I worry that some people are entertained by the idea of this war. They don't know anything about the Iraqis, but they're angry and frustrated in their own lives. It's like Germany before Hitler took over. The economy was so bad, and people felt kicked around. They looked for a scapegoat. Now we've got a new bunch of Hitlers. Martin Sheen. George W. Bush is like a bad comic working the crowd, a moron, if you'll pardon the expression. David Clennon, star of the CBS program The Agency. I'm not comparing Bush to Adolf Hitler, because George Bush, for one thing, is not as smart as Adolf Hitler. 82. Lori David. Lori David is a pain in the ass. She's the wife of Larry David, the comedy writer and actor who created Seinfeld and stars in the HBO hit Curb Your Enthusiasm. She's also an environmental crusader and a Hollywood heavy hitter when it comes to raising money for liberal causes, but mostly she's a pain in the ass. At an environmental fundraiser not long ago, Larry David got up to tell the group about his wife. This is what he said. 13 years ago, I met a materialistic, narcissistic, superficial, bosomy woman from Long Island. She was the girl of my dreams. She read People magazine, watched hours of mindless television, and shopped like there was no tomorrow. Finally, I'd met someone as shallow as me. I was hopelessly in love. We got married in a touching ceremony in Las Vegas. The cab driver who witnessed it was deeply moved. But then, after a few short months, I began to sense that something had changed. She started peppering her conversation with words like ozone layer, sustainable forestry, and toxic runoff. The very mention of the word diesel would bring on back spasms. I began to notice new people hanging around the house, people who were not in show business and wore a lot of tweed. Clearly, something was amiss. She was growing. How hideous. But what was now all too painfully obvious was that I, Larry David, the shallowest man in the world, had married an environmentalist. But not just any eco-chic Hollywood environmentalist, the kind who simply recycles and tells her kids, don't run the water when you're brushing your teeth, and leaves it at that. No, she's way beyond the baby stuff. Lori David is a true believer, the kind of activist who gets in the face of perfect strangers and reviles them as terrorist enablers for committing the unforgivable sin of driving an SUV. I've heard that you pull alongside Hummer drivers on the highway and yell at them, an interviewer once said to her. I'm very confrontational, she proudly replied. It's gotten to the point where the kids in the back seat of my car see an SUV coming and say, Mommy, please, no, don't say anything. They're horrified. But I believe in peer pressure. We have to spread the message that it isn't cool to drive gas guzzlers anymore. While it is true that Ms. David drives one of those fuel-efficient little hybrids, an article in the September 2004 Atlantic Monthly reveals that she's not always so concerned about the environment, not when her own personal comfort is involved anyway. The article calls Lori David a Gulf Stream liberal because it seems that Miss Finger-Pointing Environmentalist doesn't like to fly commercial, where she'd have to sit next to ordinary people, even the kind who fly in first class. So instead, she flies in private jets, the ones that guzzle enough fuel to poke big holes in the ozone layer. Greg Easterbrook, in the New Republic Online, picks up where The Atlantic leaves off. "I did a few quick calculations," he writes. "The mid-sized Gulfstream G200 model can carry about 2,100 gallons of jet fuel, which is made from petroleum, and would burn around 1,200 to 1,500 gallons flying from New York to Los Angeles, depending on wind speed and how many passengers were aboard. A Hummer, driven 15,000 miles, the average put on a car per year, would burn around 1,250 gallons of gasoline. So for Lori David to take one cross-country flight in a Gulfstream is the same in terms of Persian Gulf dependence and greenhouse gas emissions as if she drove a Hummer for an entire year. But then conservation is what other people should do." Lori David may be a true believing environmental activist, a major league crusader, and Hollywood heavy hitter who raises millions for liberal causes, but mostly she's a pain in the ass. So here's a memo, Earth to Lori. When it comes to lecturing us heathens about our evil ways, curb your damn enthusiasm. 81. Tim Robbins. I plugged the keywords arrogant, know-it-all, whining windbag into one of those online search engines, and it spit out Tim Robbins. As a Renaissance man of Hollywood's left-wing politics, as a triple threat, movie star, writer, and director, Robbins carries a big megaphone around with him, which he shouts into whenever he's got something to say. For example, on October 6, 2002, he told a peace rally in New York's Central Park that when Al-Qaeda hit us on September 11th, he was angry, very angry. And he wondered why New York, New York more than any other city in the world, encourages diversity of faith, he said. Are you kidding, Tim? Maybe you missed it, but Muslim fanatic killers aren't all that keen on diversity. In fact, Tim, there is no diversity inside Al-Qaeda. At all. None. As for the why New York question, because, and this is just between the two of us, Tim, that's where the towers of the World Trade Center were. That's why New York. And then Tim Robbins leaves the Central Park crowd with these deep thoughts, which the guys holding Honk for Peace signs on the side of the road would be real proud of. Let us hate war in all its forms, he says, whether its weapon is a U.S. missile or its weapon is a domestic airplane. Okay, by now it's clear that whatever else Tim Robbins is, words like shallow and smug immediately come to mind. He is a man of peace, a man who hates violence, in all its forms, right? Well, not exactly. Thanks to a March 25, 2003 column by Lloyd Grove in the Washington Post, we learn about the other Tim Robbins, the one who flashes the peace sign one minute and threatens to kick your ass the next. Here's the story. Lloyd Grove bumps into Tim Robbins and his longtime girlfriend, Susan Sarandon, at a late-night post-Academy Award party in Los Angeles. Grove says hello to Robbins and Sarandon, and things start out peacefully enough. But Grove reports, as soon as he mentions that he had the pleasure of talking recently with 79-year-old Lenora Tomalin, conservative Republican, George W. Bush supporter, and wry observer of her daughter, Susan Sarandon, his expression turned cold. Wait, you're the one who wrote about Susan's mother? Robbins demanded, as he narrowed his eyes and pursed his lips. You wanted to be divisive, and you caused trouble in my family. At this point, Grove tells us, Robbins moved within inches and said, if you ever write about my family again, I will bleeping find you, and I will bleeping hurt you. Tim Robbins was great in a movie called The Player. He'd be a natural if they ever made one called The Hypocrite. 80. Kitty Kelly. We knew all we really needed to know about Kitty Kelly, sleaze merchant extraordinaire, a long time ago. To be specific, way back in 1991, Kelly published a book that claimed to expose the sordid truth about Nancy Reagan. Kelly said that Mrs. Reagan was not her husband's beloved partner and helpmate, as the gullible American public had been led to believe, but a conscienceless user. In the book's most sensational revelation, Kelly claimed that Nancy had actually cheated on the president in the White House with Frank Sinatra. As you might guess, the liberal press ate it up. Kelly's book, Maureen Dowd, breathlessly announced in a front-page story in the New York Times, could forever shatter the Reagan myth and add allegations of scandalous sexual behavior to the folklore of the Reagan era. It was, of course, the trashiest of lies. Even Max Frankel, executive editor of the Times, was finally forced to acknowledge that repeating it on page one of his newspaper was a mistake. Not very long ago, someone like Kitty Kelly, far from getting $4 million book advances and extended sit-downs on the Today Show, would have been consigned to the sleaziest of gossip sheets, if she could even get published there. In a world where journalism had a lot more self-respect, there was simply no place for someone like her. But in today's journalism, she serves a purpose. It's a nice quid pro quo. She gets to make her millions, and the respectable press gets to spread her scurrilous poison in the guise of reporting. It also doesn't hurt that so many of Kelly's smears are aimed at conservative Republicans. Thus it is that, in her most recent hit job, she gets wide exposure in the middle of an election campaign for her claims that George W. Bush snorted cocaine during his father's presidency, denied by her own source, and Laura Bush dealt marijuana in college, again denied by her source, and still gets treated with respect, even celebrated, in elite liberal circles. So, it's useful to be reminded of how someone like Kitty Kelly should be treated. When his wife was so viciously trashed, former President Reagan, soon to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's, issued a very brief statement. This is what it said. "While I am accustomed to reports that stray from the truth, the flagrant and absurd falsehoods cited in a recently published book clearly exceed the bounds of decency. They are patently untrue. Everything from the allegation of marijuana use by Nancy and me, to marital infidelity, to my failure to be present at the birth of my daughter Patty. Many of my friends have urged me to issue a point-by-point denial of the book's many outrages. To do so, I feel, would provide legitimacy to a book that has no basis in fact and serves no decent purpose." That is called dignity, a word Kitty Kelly might want to look up sometime. 79. Harry Belafonte. As far as Harry Belafonte is concerned, Colin Powell is an Uncle Tom, maybe even a house nigger. You decide. This is what Belafonte said about Powell in an interview that aired on a San Diego radio station. "There's an old saying, in the days of slavery, there were those slaves who lived on the plantation and there were those slaves who lived in the house. You got the privilege of living in the house if you serve the master, do exactly the way the master intended to have you serve him. That gave you privilege. Colin Powell is committed to come into the house of the master, as long as he would serve the master, according to the master's purpose. And when Colin Powell dares to suggest something other than what the master wants to hear, he will be turned back out to pasture. And you don't hear much from those who live in the pasture." This raises a few questions. Why do so many who apparently see themselves as authentically black get so angry when a fellow black man strays from the liberal plantation? Why are they so afraid of diversity of opinion? Why is it okay for white people to have diversity of thought, but not for black people? Maybe the man who made Deo famous has a few thoughts on that, which he'd like to share with America. 78. Norman Mailer. "This guy isn't a murderer, he's an artist," Norman Mailer said in 1981, pleading for the release from prison of convicted murderer-turned-writer Jack Henry Abbott. "Not only the worst of the young are sent to prison, but also the best, that is, the proudest, the bravest, the most daring, the most enterprising, and the most undefeated of the poor," Mailer said. Norman Mailer, the Pulitzer Prize-winning intellectual, lobbied to get Abbott paroled. He convinced friends from around the world to do the same. Abbott was such a good writer, Mailer said, that to ignore his talent would be a crime. And besides, he said, culture is worth a little risk. Mailer's campaign succeeded. Abbott was released and went to New York, where, thanks to Norman Mailer, he became the darling of Manhattan Literary Society and a prize guest at many fancy dinner parties thrown by the city's radical chic crowd. Then, 6 weeks after he got out, Norman Mailer and everybody else learned the real meaning of culture is worth a little risk. 6 weeks after he got out, Jack Henry Abbott got into an argument with a 22-year-old waiter and stabbed him to death. Mailer told reporters he hoped Abbott would not get a life sentence if convicted because it would destroy him. At his trial, the prosecutor read from Abbott's bestseller, Belly of the Beast, a short paragraph about how you stab a man to death. You move your left foot to the side to step across his right side, body length, a light pivot toward him with your right shoulder, and the world turns upside down. You have sunk the knife to its hilt. Slowly, he begins to struggle for his life. You can feel his life trembling through the knife. When he finished reading, the prosecutor asked Abbott, "Did you write that?" With a smirk, Abbott replied, "It's good, isn't it?" After Abbott was found guilty, Norman Mailer said that he felt a very large responsibility for what happened. He also said, "I am willing to gamble with certain elements in society to save this man's talent." Today, Norman Mailer is among the many intellectuals and celebrities pleading for the release of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was convicted of killing Philadelphia police officer Danny Faulkner. Mailer apparently doesn't believe Abu-Jamal really is a murderer either. 77. Linda Hirschman. Linda Hirschman is not the best-known feminist in America, but she just may be the most self-important, smug, condescending one in the whole bunch, and that is no small accomplishment. I had never heard of Linda Hirschman until I saw her on 60 Minutes in October 2004 in a story by Leslie Stahl about young, well-educated women who were choosing to leave their high-paying, high-powered, prestigious jobs in order to stay at home with their young kids. To many Americans, of course, this is great news. I mean, what could be more important than taking care of your own little children? But to Linda Hirschman, lawyer, philosophy professor, and author, women like these are hopelessly misguided at best. After all, she informs us, in that self-important tone so common to those of the feminist left, we're talking about smart women, powerful women. These are the women, she said, that would have gone into the jobs that run our world. These are the women who would eventually have become senators, governors. These women would have been in the pipeline to be the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. Hearing this, even Leslie Stahl seemed taken aback. "But how can you tell them what the right decision is?" she asked. "Well, I mean, I'm a philosopher. Of course I can tell them what the right decision is," Linda Hirschman shot back, adding, "As Mark Twain said, a man who chooses not to read is just as ignorant as a man who cannot read." "But that's so judgmental," Stahl said. "You know, that's such a loaded word," the philosopher responded. "These women," she said, "are choosing lives in which they do not use their capacity for very complicated work. They're choosing lives in which they do not use their capacity to deal with very powerful other adults in the world, which takes a lot of skill. I think there are better lives and worse lives." There are better lives and there are worse lives. And thank God for Linda Hirschman, because she's right there, ready to tell all of us dummies which is which. 76. Barbara Foley. What is it about higher education that encourages political idiocy? It's a very good question, succinctly asked by the New Criterion, a journal that speaks up for common sense, one of the casualties along with common decency in our culture these days. Consider the case of Barbara Foley, a Marxist professor of English at Rutgers University in New Jersey. An essay in the magazine's Notes and Comments column begins just 1 month after September 11, 2001. Yes, let's consider it. Not because Barbara Foley is especially notable, but precisely because she's not, and because the views she espouses are so typical on campuses across America. In the wake of the deadly assaults on New York and Washington, the New Criterion article continues, Foley posted a message on the internet for her students. It dealt partly with readings for the class, partly with the terrorist attacks. "We should," Foley wrote, "be aware that whatever its proximate cause, its ultimate cause is the fascism of U.S. foreign policy over the past many decades." Translation, it was our fault. We brought the mayhem of 9/11 down on ourselves, and by implication, we deserve what we got. And if you can somehow get beyond that, then consider, as the New Criterion does, the simple matter of plain old common decency. "Such behavior," the magazine writes, "by an on-duty college professor is completely inappropriate, of course. There is, first of all, the matter of gross insensitivity. What if some of her students lost a parent, a spouse, a sibling in those attacks? How would they like being told that the cause was a fascist foreign policy of the United States? There is also the larger issue," the essay says, "of what an English professor is doing using official communications with her class as a soapbox for political proselytizing. Since when did memoranda about readings for a class in American literature," the magazine asks, "become occasions for expatiating on the supposed evils of American foreign policy?" These are all good questions, but not as good as the one we began with. What is it about higher education that encourages political idiocy? 75. Eric Foner. Eric Foner, professor of history at Columbia University, isn't just another run-of-the-mill left-wing academic. He's a major league player in his field, a past president of the American Historical Association. Foner's many books are used in high school and college classrooms throughout America, helping shape the perceptions of countless students about their country and its role in the world. Which is why what he had to say after September 11, 2001 matters a lot, and why it's so depressing. This is what he said. "I'm not sure which is more frightening," he said, "the horror that engulfed New York City or the apocalyptic rhetoric emanating daily from the White House. If the good professor truly isn't sure which is more frightening, then a reasonable person can draw only one conclusion, that Eric Foner, despite his PhD, is a fool." Can you imagine if someone on the right had said, "I'm not sure which is more frightening, the horror that engulfed New York City or the moronic drivel that routinely emanates from the mouths of professors at some of our most elite universities and is poisoning both the mind and the soul of so many impressionable young students?" Actually, that's not a bad question. 74. Katha Pollitt. Just days after September 11, 2001, a journalist named Katha Pollitt, a columnist for the left-wing magazine The Nation, who also writes regularly for The New Yorker and The New York Times, did a piece for The Nation called "Put Out No Flags." "My daughter, who goes to Stuyvesant High School only blocks from the World Trade Center," she wrote, "thinks we should fly an American flag out our window. Definitely not, I say. The flag stands for jingoism and vengeance and war." After a bit of give and take, during which Miss Pollitt half-heartedly acknowledges that her daughter may have a point about how the flag can also mean standing together and honoring the dead, they reach a compromise. "I tell her she can buy a flag with her own money and fly it out her bedroom window, because that's hers, but the living room is off limits." I wonder if Miss Pollitt really understands that if either one of those hijackers who had taken aim at the Twin Towers had been just a little off target, she might never have had that discussion with her daughter about the American flag. Her daughter might very well have been buried under a pile of rubble on September 11th, murdered as she sat in history or English class at her school just a few blocks from the World Trade Center. I understand that the world is a complicated place, that issues are complex, and that are rarely all black or all white. I understand that the good guys don't always do the right thing. But I also understand that it takes a certain kind of American in the days right after September 11, 2001, to tell her young daughter that the American flag stands for jingoism and vengeance and war. In normal times, this would be bad enough, but in times of crisis, it really is repulsive. '73, Barbara Kingsolver. My daughter came home from kindergarten and announced, "Tomorrow, we all have to wear red, white, and blue." This is how the novelist and left-wing social critic Barbara Kingsolver begins an op-ed right after September 11, 2001. Why, she wants to know. For all the people that died when the airplanes hit the buildings, the little girl explains. For most Americans, this would seem like a nice, loving gesture. Not to Barbara Kingsolver. She asks her daughter why she can't simply wear black. Why does she have to wear the colors of the flag? What does that mean, she wants to know. It means we're a country, just all people together, the young girl innocently replies. When a little girl in kindergarten sounds, no, make that is, smarter than her mother, you know there's a problem. The next day, Kingsolver tells us, she sent her daughter to school in red, white, and blue. She also tells us that my wise husband put a hand on my arm and said, "You can't let hateful people steal the flag from us." As I got to this part in the op-ed, I said, finally, someone in the house beside the kid with some common sense. Of course you can't let those hateful bastards who killed so many Americans that day steal the flag from us. Stupid me. He didn't mean terrorists, Barbara Kingsolver explains. He meant Americans. Americans? What Americans? Like the man in a city near us, she writes, who went on a rampage crying, "I'm an American," as he shot at foreign-born neighbors. You see, one jerk, maybe even several jerks, in a nation of nearly 300 million people goes on a rampage, and this is all the proof she needs that the real enemy of this country, the enemy we all need to fear, is patriotism. No kidding, patriotism. Here is Barbara Kingsolver in her own words. Patriotism threatens free speech with death. It despises people of foreign birth. In other words, the American flag stands for intimidation, censorship, violence, bigotry, sexism, homophobia, and shoving the Constitution through a paper shredder? Who are we calling terrorists here? Kingsolver wrote. There is a temptation to feel at least a moment's pity for this woman with such dark fantasies about her own country. But the one I really feel sorry for is her poor defenseless daughter. 72. War Churchill. On September 11, 2001, 1,600 very long miles from the nightmarish devastation in New York City, a college professor named War Churchill, who teaches ethnic studies at the University of Colorado, sat down to write about what had happened to America that day. "The most that can honestly be said of those involved on September 11th," he wrote, "is that they finally responded in kind to some of what this country has dispensed to their people as a matter of course." Of the innocent civilians who perished in the Twin Towers, Professor Churchill had this to say. "Well, really, let's get a grip here, shall we? True enough, they were civilians of a sort, but innocent? Give me a break." But even that wasn't quite enough to sum up his feelings on the events of the day. War Churchill proceeded to compare the people who were killed in the World Trade Center to Adolf Eichmann, the architect of the Holocaust, the one who masterminded the slaughter of 6 million Jews. Churchill's vile little essay, which initially appeared only on the internet and later became part of a book, didn't make a ripple back in 2001 in what they like to call the scholarly community, or any place else for that matter. But in early 2005, when he was about to speak in Hamilton College in upstate New York, The whole sorry mess came to light and prompted Churchill to clarify his position. If we want an end to violence, he clarified, especially that perpetrated against civilians, we must take the responsibility for halting the slaughter perpetrated by the United States around the world. As for those comments comparing the victims in the Twin Towers to Nazis, an exasperated War Churchill now explained that not every person killed in the Twin Towers was a little Eichmann. How dumb of us to jump to that conclusion. The janitors weren't Nazis, he said, and neither were the food service workers or even the firemen. Just the technocrats, as he put it, the men and women who were keeping the American economy going by engaging in business. Only they were the little Eichmanns who just got what they had coming. I'm of the school that believes that War Churchill should be allowed to keep his job. The good news is that in the end, War Churchill is of little significance, a lightweight who happened to have the misfortune of catching our attention. The bad news is there are many, many War Churchills on American college campuses today, unapologetic America bashers who every day abuse their important positions to undermine the very free exchange of ideas universities are supposed to encourage. 71. Phil Donahue. No need to be cruel to Phil Donahue, a man whose time has come and gone. As Matt Drudge put it, when Donahue's last Little Watch talk show was mercifully canceled by MSNBC in 2003, how can you tell? But that doesn't mean we should go easy on him either, because Phil Donahue is one of those pioneers who has had a huge effect on the most popular medium in human history, and by extension, on how we all live and think. You can make a case that more than any other individual, Donahue has made the world safe for emotion, masquerading as thought. And when Phil launched TV's first modern television talk show in 1967 on WLWD-TV in Dayton, Ohio, with atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare as his first guest, this was a very different America. While much of the country was still trying to hang on to its old values, the times were rapidly changing. There was the turmoil of Vietnam. There was the racial violence, not to mention the casual sex and drugs. There was enough going on in the country to make Phil Donahue a rising star. In showbiz talk, his timing couldn't have been better. Within a few years, he was a national bona fide phenomenon, creating a whole new kind of daytime TV, not merely interviewing people, but dashing with his mic from the stage into the studio audience like a wide-eyed choir boy to include ordinary people in the discussion about some of the most important issues of the day. Donahue's show was so new and so fresh that we hardly even stopped to realize how far, even for a liberal, his ideas were from the mainstream. Of course, there were hints right from the beginning. When barcodes were introduced in 1974, for example, Phil denounced them as a corporate plot against consumers. Barcodes. For all I know, he still believes that. But mainly what he did in show after show, year after year, nearly 7,000 before he finally quit, was give tremendous exposure and his own strong support to the forces challenging traditional beliefs and behavior. Donahue was not merely a feminist, but a cheerleader for feminism's most radical wing. He was constantly infuriated that any mere man, especially a mere white one, would dare so much as question a woman's right to have an abortion. And during the height of the AIDS epidemic in America, Phil endlessly parroted the gay activist line in defiance of the facts that AIDS was everyone's disease rather than one overwhelmingly confined to gay men and junkies, and that how one got it doesn't matter, except that how one got it mattered a lot. It was a matter of life and death. Then again, this was just in keeping with Donahue's long-time advice to viewers on personal responsibility, which was basically, if at all possible, avoid it. Violent crime, homelessness, rotten parenting, whatever the issue, on Phil's show, there was always someone or something to blame, society or the government or the legal system, and always a psychiatrist or social worker right there on the stage to lend weight to the it's not your fault, you're a victim mentality. Enough. Let's leave Phil with his 20 Emmys and his Peabody for sensitive yet probing interviews on issues relevant to today's society. With his Media Person of the Year Award from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, and his President's Award from the National Women's Political Caucus, with his lovely wife Marlo Thomas, and with his memories. All we ask in return is that he continues to leave us alone. 70. Jimmy Swaggart. There are those, okay, let's go ahead and call them liberals, who see intolerance everywhere, including all kinds of places where it is not. They see it in anyone who thinks it makes more sense for airline security personnel to pay more attention to young Arab men than to 82-year-old grandmas from Dubuque. They see it in those who believe that kids should get into college on the basis of merit, not skin color. And they see it, too, in those who, on the basis of religious belief, object to aspects of the gay agenda that would overturn thousands of years of Western moral tradition. People who see intolerance everywhere are so aggressive in pushing their views, both in the media and through the courts, that lots of us have come to regard the very word intolerance as a red flag. We hear the word and we think, here they go again, the militant forces of tolerance, trying to shut up everyone who dares to disagree with them. The fact is, for some of us, that feeling is so strong that we sometimes forget something important, that there really is such a thing as genuine intolerance, and that it can be as ugly now as it ever was. There can be genuine racism, and genuine sexism, and genuine gay bashing. And if we're intellectually honest and morally consistent, when it rears its ugly head, we should call it what it is. Which brings us to TV evangelist Jimmy Swaggart. "I've never seen a man in my life I wanted to marry," Swaggart said during a church sermon on September 12, 2004, and he continued, "And I'm going to be blunt and plain. If one ever looks at me like that, I'm going to kill him and tell God he died." When this came to light, Swaggart eventually issued an apology. He said he was only joking, but that if he offended anyone he said he would kill, he was sorry. 69. Matt Kunitz. Matt Kunitz is the executive producer of Fear Factor, the NBC primetime TV reality show that has featured the following stunts, where contestants, the female ones often wearing very little, had to eat a pizza with a crust made of cow bile, a sauce made of coagulated blood paste, cheese that was rancid, and toppings that included red worms, live red worms. Other contestants were covered with 400 rats. Still others were put in a body bag and a drawer in a morgue. The bag was filled with giant hissing cockroaches. Other contestants had to eat African cave-dwelling spiders, again, live ones. Still other contestants had to stick their faces in a jar full of cow eyeballs, pick them up without using their hands, and puncture them with their teeth. Here's a reality show the geniuses in Hollywood might want to do. It's called Lunatics Run the Asylum. It's all about them. 68. Katherine Hansen. Christina Hoff Sommers, the brave ex-philosophy professor who took on the radical feminist crazies in Who Stole Feminism and the War Against Boys, has seen a lot of ugly, politically motivated misinformation in her day peddled by left-wing feminist ideologues. So when she says that Katherine Hansen's facts are the most outrageously distorted I have yet to come across, it's time to sit up and listen. Hansen is a self-styled expert in the culture of violence. She believes that in this country we socialize males to be aggressive, powerful, unemotional, and controlling, and that such activities as Little League baseball encourage aggressive, violent behavior. Two of Hansen's more provocative facts cited by Sommers are these. Every year, nearly 4 million women are beaten to death in the United States. Violence is the leading cause of death among women. Let's see. That would mean 11,000 women are beaten to death in this country every single day of the year. That would come to 40 million women beaten to death in 10 years, 160 million in 40 years. Why, in a couple of generations, there'd be no women left. As Summers points out, the total number of female deaths annually in the United States from all causes is approximately 1 million, and the total number murdered is around 4,000. Just for the record, the real leading cause of death for women is heart disease, 370,000 deaths per year, followed by cancer, 250,000. All of which would be bad enough if Katherine Hansen were just another in the legion of ideologically driven women's studies profs on the nation's campuses, ranting to a couple of classes of students, mostly female, who are more than willing to believe anything she tells them. We should be so lucky. You see, Katherine Hansen is one of those angry radical feminists who have helped set the agenda in classrooms all across the country. Indeed, in the 90s, the organization she headed, the Women's Educational Equity Act Publishing Center, became the national clearinghouse for so-called gender-fair educational material bound for American teachers and schoolchildren. Under the auspices of Bill Clinton's Department of Education, Hansen's outfit produced more than 350 publications and distributed material to hundreds of educational conferences. Summers reports that by the year 2000, Hansen's organization had received more than $75 million in federal funds, otherwise known as your tax dollars. How was that money spent? Well, one typical publication Hansen's group helped fund was an anti-harassment and anti-violence guide for teachers, grades K through 3, called Quit It, which instructed teachers on how to socialize little boys away from typical little boy behavior. For example, before going outside to play, the report said, talk about how students feel about playing a game of tag. Do they like to be chased? Do they like to do the chasing? How does it feel to be tagged out? Get their ideas about other ways the game might be played, the guide said. Here's an idea. How about if radical feminists took a long walk on a short pier and just let kids be kids? 67. Randall Robinson. As if there's not already enough bitterness and misunderstanding in this country on the subject of race, along comes Randall Robinson with a bright idea. Reparations. Robinson is a Harvard law grad as well as founder and former president of a group called Trans Africa, which seeks to influence American policy towards African and Caribbean countries. The United States is obliged to come to terms with its past and to make the victims whole, Robinson has written. This means compensation, restitution, reparations. After all, he argues, Germany has paid billions to survivors of the Holocaust, and in 1988, the United States compensated Japanese Americans in turn during World War II. And besides, he says, America was largely built by centuries of free labor. An apology is not the end of the matter, Robinson says. An apology is the beginning of the matter. It's a passionate, heartfelt argument that makes you think. The problem is that when you do, you're hit by the obvious. That as immoral as slavery was, it ended more than 140 years ago. And unlike those who survived the Holocaust and those Japanese Americans who were kept in camps against their will, slavery's actual victims are long gone, as are the people who kept the whole nasty system going. In fact, millions upon millions of our ancestors weren't even in this country back in the days of slavery, and among those who were, hundreds of thousands died at Gettysburg and on a lot of other battlefields to end slavery. Still, it's true that the vestiges of slavery, segregation, violence, and everyday humiliation lingered long after the Emancipation Proclamation. So, if we as a people decide to pay reparations to black Americans, how much would be enough? How much do we give someone whose ancestors were slaves? Is $100,000 enough? Is $10,000 per person enough? And do we really think that reparations would fix what ails Black America? Do we think that the horrendous out-of-wedlock birth rate among Blacks in this country would drop because of this one-time payment of reparations? Do we think that Black kids who disproportionately are failing in school would somehow do better because of reparations? But Randall Robinson's case for reparations is misguided in still another, even more important way. It casts Black Americans as perpetual victims, unable to make it in this country on their own merits. As the historian Anders G. Lewis observes in Front Page magazine, in singing the song of racist persecution, Robinson demeans the sacrifices and successes of so many great Black men and women from the past and present, rebels, intellectuals, activists, judges, and public officials. And the more you do listen to Randall Robinson, the more you begin to realize that he's not nearly as noble as liberals may think. For one thing, he doesn't seem to have much use for white people, who, according to Robinson, once well inside the place of another's different, less pugnacious, more welcoming culture, destroy it, root and branch. For inexplicable reasons, he says, they are seemingly constrained by some aberrant force of nature to disparage all culture, all history, all religion, all memory, all faces, all life, not theirs. This is the reason he believes that only white countries are capable of killing so many people at one time. Never mind that the Hutu slaughtered nearly a million Tutsi in Rwanda. In 2004, Robinson said, "Whites don't give a shit what we think. Never did, never will." So Randall Robinson, as Anders G. Lewis informs us, took his criticism of this country to its logical conclusion. He has moved out of the United States. Yes, indeed, Randall Robinson packed his bags and moved to the Caribbean island of St. Kitts. I hope the godfather of reparations is happy there, and with all due respect, that he stays there. 66. David Duke. Remember that old game, Dead or Alive? I see a name and you have to guess if the person is dead or alive. David Duke, dead or alive. If you said alive, I'm afraid you're right. David Duke, who just might be America's most famous bigot with good hair, has been off the radar screen for the past few years because he was in federal prison for tax and mail fraud, and before that he was living in Russia, where, no kidding, he wrote an article called "Is Russia the Key to White Survival?" David Duke wasn't the kind of imperial wizard to rest on his laurels. In recent years, he's been a busy little bigot. He wrote a couple of books about his racial consciousness, from childhood to what passes for adulthood, and about the worldwide Jewish threat. He also talks from time to time about the so-called Holocaust and about how it's been blown way out of proportion, exaggerated, as he puts it. He's also quoted as telling an interviewer, "You know, they had a soccer field at Auschwitz, they had an orchestra at Auschwitz, and the band was for the prisoners' enjoyment, for their pleasure." But on September 11, 2001, David Duke hit the crackpot jackpot. From that day on, he had a brand new opportunity to do what he does best: blame the Jews for everything bad in the world. A year after 9/11, Duke went on the World Wide Web to share his thoughts on how the Jews did us in yet again. He called his essay "The Big Lie," the true reason behind the attacks of September 11th. And what exactly is the truth? That if it weren't for United States support of Israel, none of this would have ever happened to us. "Many traitors in our government," he wrote, "have supported Zionism's criminal activities rather than the true interests of the American people. They have spawned the hatred against America that drove on these terrible acts. They are as much responsible for the carnage of September 11th as if they themselves piloted these planes that were turned into bombs." So said David Duke. Stuff like this has made David Duke a popular guy in certain circles. A news item on November 12, 2002, out of Dubai, begins this way: A former U.S. senator is to arrive today in Bahrain to lecture on behind-the-scenes influence of the Zionist lobby on U.S. politics at the invitation of a local religious center, a spokesman told Gulf News yesterday. Indeed, this is why David Duke cannot be ignored. That he never was a U.S. senator doesn't stop those in the Arab world, and heaven knows where else, from identifying him as a mainstream politician. And in these places, he gets a serious hearing. Discredited as he is in his homeland, David Duke is nonetheless a pestilence that refuses to go away. Let's face it. If anyone belongs on a list like this, he does, because if they gave out awards for bigotry, David Duke would pick up a plaque for lifetime achievement. I wonder if he'd attend the ceremony in his white robe or his brown shirt. 65. Oliver Stone. In 2004, Oliver Stone's movie Alexander bombed at the box office and was greeted with reviews like this one by John Podhoretz. Oliver Stone's Alexander, which opens today, isn't just bad, it's springtime for a Hitler bad. But there's no need to shed tears for Oliver Stone. He's had a long, successful run in Hollywood, and he hasn't deserved much of it. The problem with Oliver Stone is not really that he's a leftist with paranoid fantasies about sinister forces running America. People have a right to their delusions. Besides, in Hollywood, having fashionably leftist delusions is always an excellent career move. The problem isn't even that Stone lies about history and unloads his fantasies on the rest of us in his movies. It's his right as an artist. The word they like to use in the creative community to describe themselves, to put whatever he wants on film as long as he can get someone to pay for it. No, the problem is that, even as he plays fast and loose with facts, distorting things in the most unscrupulous and heavy-handed way, Oliver Stone cavalierly goes out of his way to present his warped take on events as real, authentic history. This would be bad enough at any time. How we see our past, after all, has everything to do with how we see ourselves as a people, with whether we view our country and its leaders as basically decent and well-intentioned or fundamentally indecent and corrupt. But it's more appalling than ever right now, in an era when fewer and fewer Americans, especially young ones, know very much about history. A lot of kids actually think that if they see it in a movie, and if it looks real, then it must be real. So you want to know who killed the president and connived to cover it up, Time magazine asked in a piece about Stone's 1991 movie JFK. Everybody, high officials in the CIA, the FBI, the Dallas Constabulary, all three armed services, big business and the White House, everybody done it. Everybody but Lee Harvey Oswald, said Time magazine. Then there was Stone's 1995 film, Nixon, where he tried to inoculate himself against such criticism by releasing a massive file of documentation along with the movie itself. This scholarly blitz impressed reporters and reviewers, but it is fraudulent, wrote the historian Stephen Ambrose, whose biography of Nixon was one of the sources quoted or misquoted by Stone in his movie. Ambrose goes on to detail how Stone twists the research just so he can make whatever points he feels like making in his movie. Examples of Stone's inventions, writes Ambrose, include Nixon saying about John Kennedy, "We were like brothers for Christ's sake," or Pat Nixon's demanding a divorce, or Mouse telling Nixon, "You're as evil as I am. Others pay to feed the hunger in us. In my case, millions of reactionaries. In your case, millions of Vietnamese."